against Palestinians, as well as to all international forums. The Zionist regime's onslaught will not be deterred by absenteeism from the Knesset sessions, but rather by their obstruction and abrogation. Simple absenteeism has no teeth. At the same time, the Arab parties should not be fooled into believing that what is happening on the ground is the product of the policy of a single government. Rather, it is a policy of deep state backed by its aggressive colonial history, from David Ben-Gurion to Bennett. The only deterrence to this policy is popular struggle and Palestinian Arab steadfastness in the Naqab and beyond. The Naqab today serves as the current battleground, and the Naqab belongs not only to its current inhabitants, but to all of Palestinians. What is most heartening to see is the strongest presence of a new generation in the Naqab, carrying the banner of a struggle and fulfilling the promise of its continuation. This is what will deter the colonial project alongside Palestinians' struggle for freedom and national dignity.
Prophet. Man was created on the morning of the sixth day. The time of worship commenced. And Adam began the rituals for his Lord. He, and after him, his progeny, performed such rituals. Religions appeared one after another. All of them represented one God, one path, one origin, and one end to mankind. Every messenger who was appointed by God to convey his message informed the people of the advent of the last prophet of God. In this sense, Buddha and Krishna said the very same thing which Noah, Abraham, Moses, John, Zoroaster, and Jesus said. One told the name of the final prophet, and the other spoke of his origin. One forecast the signs of his homeland, while the other described the characteristics of his language. In one way or another, each prophet informed mankind of the joyous news of the advent of the final prophet, the last messenger of the heavens. In the very beginning of history, God sent Adam, his first prophet on earth, to propagate and show the heavenly path to the inhabitants of this world. Thousands of years have passed ever since, and some people continue to follow him by residing exclusively near the riverbanks of the world. Zoroastrianism is one of the most ancient religions of the world. These days, most of its followers are found in Iran, India, and some regions of Central Asia. They possess a heritage several thousand years old. Like the prophets before him, Zoroaster also informed his followers of the coming of divine prophets. The religious scripts of Zoroastrianism refer to these messengers as Sotians. There are three Sotients who were foretold to appear after the Zoroaster. Alternatively, three Sotients, three beneficent personalities, will come one after the other. Throughout history, the followers of Zoroaster have been waiting for their arrival. They have searched for them everywhere. So far, only three Zoroastrian sages have succeeded in seeing the first Sotient in Bethlehem. When the last prophet of God appeared in Hejaz, there were many Zoroastrians who saw the signs of the second Sotient in him. They joined him in large numbers and became his followers and helpers. However, there are still many Zoroastrians who are keenly waiting for the arrival of the third Sotient. They hope that this universal reformer will appear and make the world a utopia. In India, the land of many creeds, there are several mysterious religions spread out in the vast jungles and mountainous regions. Here, you find religions such as Hinduism, Jainism, Buddhism, and Sikhism. Though in some case, the followers of these religions have become deviated from the right path. The depth of meaning and spirituality that these religions reveal is indicative of man's inherent tendency to establish a close relationship with an infallible creator and worship him. Historical roots of Hinduism are spread over thousands of years. Mysterious ascetics with wonderful conducts live all over India, in colorful shrines and dark temples in legendary jungles. They make the unspeakable things of this mysterious land even more mysterious.
God is one only. Even in India, in the Hindu philosophy, God is always one. But his manifestation is many.
This historical religion has several holy books as guidelines for its followers. These books are full of strange and unsaid mysteries. Among the sacred books of Hindus are the Puranas. These ancient books contain the history of the universe, the genealogy of kings and heroes, and the foretelling of future events. In these books, we again witness indications of the coming of a spiritual teacher called Muhammad from a foreign land. To him is what Raja Bhuj respectfully says. I prostrate myself before you, O you, the pride of mankind, the inhabitant of Arabia. You have gathered a great power to eradicate Satan.
In one of the Puranas in India, Bhavishya Purana, it is also mentioned that Mahamud, Paigambar Muhammad, will be born in the Middle East, and he would cleanse the people of corruption and bad habits there, and you know, he will bring a new wave of devotion. This is mentioned thousands of years ago in the Hindu texts, in a Purana. It's one verse is there, one quote is there, that such and such a person, a prediction was done about that.
He will appear appear in a sandy desert in the land of Arabia. He will be known as the pride of humanity, and his name is Muhammad. What could be the secret that has been also mentioned in the holy books of Hindus, and of which the Hindu monks have spoken? The history of Jainism goes back about 600 years before the appearance of Christ. According to Jainism, salvation can only be achieved through the practice of asceticism. The tenets of this faith dictate that God has 24 avatars on earth. The last one of them will be born in a peninsula, and the name of his father is Vishnu Bhagat, which is the equivalent of Abdullah. And the name of his mother is Somaneve, which is the equivalent of Amina. He is said to be taught by Bhagwan in a cave. Sikhs, who wear a unique turban on their head, are followers of another religion in India. But are there any hints about the holy prophet of Islam and his religion in the scriptures of Sikhs? In addition to the promise made thousands of years ago by Eastern religions concerning the advent of a prophet called Muhammad in Arabia, Abrahamic religions also foretell the arrival of a great prophet on earth in the last age of humanity. Moses and Jesus endured many difficulties on the path of propagating their messages. They promised the people about the advent of a man from among the descendants of Abraham. The New Testament clearly promises the arrival of a prophet after Christ. An example of this can be seen in the Gospel of John. Shortly before the advent of Christ, Roman oppression was continuously increasing. More and more innocent people were crucified every day, and the poor were made even poorer through forced taxes. In such conditions, a man called John, from the shores of the Jordanian River, claimed prophecy. He kindled both doubt and hope in the hearts of the Jews of his time. Perhaps they wondered whether he was Messiah, the prophet foretold to end pain and tragedy. On the same day, Jewish leaders sent a group of Levites to John to investigate the matter.
"Who are you?"
John confessed. He did not deny. He answered,
"I am not the Messiah."
"Who are you then?
Are you Elijah?"
"No, I'm not."
"Are you the prophet?"
"No."
"Then tell us who you are."
"We have to take an answer back to those
when
who sent us."
When Prophet John replied that he was not Messiah, Elijah, or the promised prophet, the delegates, who were considering the new prophet to be one of these three, asked him in wonder,
"If you're not the Messiah, nor Elijah, nor the prophet, why do you baptize?"
"I baptize with water, but among you stands the one you do not know. He is coming after me, but I'm not good enough even to untie his sandals."
John's Gospel contains a marvelous secret within it. This secret, which reveals itself exclusively to those possessing wisdom and intellect, promises the advent of another prophet after Jesus. It speaks of a messenger for whom everyone is waiting. When Christ embarked upon his three-year-long mission, a great disagreement occurred among people.
And whoever believes in me should drink. As the scripture says, streams of life-giving water will pour out from his side. This man is really the prophet! The Messiah will not come from Galilee!
Many people said that he was the Messiah promised by the Bible. However, others did not agree to this, and said that perhaps he was the foretold prophet. What we can understand from John's Gospel is that apart from Elijah, two other people must also come to mankind. One is the Messiah, and the other is, for the lack of a better title, the prophet. But where is the prophet, who according to John's Gospel must come, and has yet to come?
All the Christianity believe in the genuineness of Prophet Muhammad. I mean, believe that he was a prophet or not.
I do not know for all of Christianity. I have no doubt. I have no doubt myself. He is a prophet, and spoke the word of God with great love and kindness and beauty.
Yes,
the prophet is a symbol. The prophet is a human being. Human being, not God. He's a human being that he had great faith, a maximum of the faith, and he was in contact with God when he was alive. And he passed the messages of God to the people.
Will Durant writes, according to the documents discovered on the shores of the Dead Sea, people were awaiting the foretold prophet, whose appearance, along with that of the Messiah, was promised. But who is this prophet, and from where does he originate? In order to answer this question, we will have to go back and investigate his characteristics, as found in the Old Testament. According to the Old Testament, Moses saved the children of Israel from the Egyptians' bondage, and made them cross the sea. He guided them during the course of 40 years of wandering in the Sinai Desert until they reached the banks of the Jordanian River. Nevertheless, the Israelites continued their lives as nomads. For this reason, Moses gathered them all and said, God told me, I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren like unto thee, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all. But I shall command him, and it shall come to pass, that whosoever will not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, I will require it of him. The Bible only recognizes the children of Ishmael as the brethren of the Israelites. Hence, the foretold prophet must have been raised among the brethren of the Israelites. He must have been given a book like that of Moses, and he must have come with a religious law like that of Moses. The question stands, to which prophet can all these qualities be attributed? Priest James Dow writes in the Collins Dictionary of the Bible, the only personality for whom the forecast of Torah can fit is Muhammad, because he is the only person who resembles Moses and has a book and a religious law. The prophets came one after the other and guided humanity towards the truth. Every prophet promised his followers about the advent of the last messenger of God, Muhammad, about whom the Puranas had promised, the second sociant of the Zoroastrians, a prophet from Arabia, the last avatar riding on a horse, the prophet resembling Moses and the descendant of the brethren of the Israelites, and the prophet mentioned in John's Gospel. Who is he? In which land was he raised? In which era did he render as true the promise of all the prophets before him, after centuries of denial and defiance by the unbelievers? Muhammad, the son of Abdullah, titled as Ahmad, the seal of all prophets, from the house of Ishmael, appeared in the land of the Arabs to guide mankind, so that man may not remain in the darkness of ignorance. And now, on the threshold of another millennium, man continues the path of his predecessors in the persecution of the propagators of the message of God, those who decapitated Prophet John, put the cross on the shoulders of Christ, and mounted the Crusades, are once again continuing with their blasphemous persecution of the last prophet of God. They fed their ancient grudge. They despised the sacred, and driven to despair, they set fire to the truth and tried desperately to injure the prophet.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. Scotland Yard statement that it has asked for minimal references to certain events covered in Sue Gray's Partygate report provoked confusion and anger. The effect of Friday, 28th of January intervention was to diminish the chances of Gray's report being published in full anytime soon. It also heightened speculation about what the force is actually investigating. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Aubrey Allegretti, Vikram Dodd, Hannah Devlin and Heather Stewart. The piece is titled Sue Gray Report, UK Government Sources Say Redacted Version is Imminent. Please stay with us for more. The Guardian understands a heavily redacted report into Downing Street parties by the senior civil servant Sue Gray will be published imminently after Scotland Yard provoked fury and confusion by revealing it had demanded key details be removed. British MPs labelled the Metropolitan Police a broken organisation after the force admitted it had asked Sue Gray to make minimal reference in her inquiry report to matters its officers were now investigating. Sue Gray's team had been considering sending a redacted version of the report to Number 10, or waiting for the Metropolitan Police to conclude its inquiry and then sending the full report. On Friday night, 28th of January, the British government sources said they decided to send a redacted version at the request of the Metropolitan Police. They're not believed to be intending to submit anything further to Downing Street. Earlier, Britain's Labour Party had called for a full report to be published. It said the government was in a state of extended paralysis, while some Tory backbenchers described Prime Minister Boris Johnson as a lame duck without the authority to tackle the looming cost of living crisis and possible Russian invasion of Ukraine. Scotland Yard had issued a brief statement on Friday morning, 28th of January, saying it was in ongoing contact with Sue Gray's team about the content of the report to avoid any prejudice to our investigation. Police stressed they had not asked for the document to be delayed, but their request left Gray unable to publish the Partygate report as she intended. On Friday night, in a further statement, the Metropolitan Police said it had received information from the Cabinet Office to support its investigation into potential breaches of COVID-19 regulations at a number of events in Downing Street and Whitehall. Commander Catherine Roper, who leads the Metropolitan Police's Central Specialist Crime Command, claimed officers would look at the material without fear or favour, promptly, fairly and proportionately. She added anyone suspected of breaching COVID rules would be contacted in writing and invited to explain their actions, including whether they feel they had a reasonable excuse, after which officers will decide if enforcement action should be taken. The Metropolitan Police understood to be looking into wrongdoing that could warrant fixed penalty notices rather than any more serious offences. If those issued with the fixed penalty notices want to challenge the fine, they would go before a magistrate and not a jury. Boris Johnson's political future may hinge on whether he and senior Number 10 staff are exonerated or criticised. And the Metropolitan Police's intervention prompted concerns that the issue could remain unresolved into the spring if key details of the report remain unpublished. Questions had been raised about the suitability of sending Boris Johnson the full report when events he could have been present at are potentially those the Metropolitan Police are investigating. Earlier, one Tory MP raised concerns that Sue Gray's full findings may not emerge. They told The Guardian, what people want is justice and the truth. What they expect is a cover-up. If that's what happens, we can take another 5% of our standing in the polls. It's a massive loss of confidence in the police and damaging for the party. Another called the Metropolitan Police a broken organisation and said fears the report would look like a whitewash were the fault of Scotland Yard's incompetence. While Downing Street vowed on Friday, 28th of January, to release whatever findings it receives from Sue Gray, but said the Metropolitan Police should be given time and space to complete its independent work. Those with knowledge of the Metropolitan Police's thinking said senior officers do not want Sue Gray's findings of wrongdoing published in detail before those who may be interviewed are spoken to by police, potentially polluting the recall of witnesses. But the Metropolitan Police's fears that Sue Gray's Partygate report could prejudice its own investigation prompted widespread incredulity, given the risk only arises when a criminal investigation is launched that is expected to lead to arrests, followed by a trial by jury. Nazir Afzal, a former Chief Crown Prosecutor for Northwest England, called the announcement by the Metropolitan Police defending its demand for redactions absolute nonsense, adding, "A purely factual report by Sue Gray cannot possibly prejudice a police investigation. They just have to follow the evidence of which the report will be a part of." Dal Babu, a former Metropolitan Police Chief Superintendent, said he was a little bit confused about the force's decision. He said he was struggling to understand why this report would impede the police investigation, given it had no legal standing and a lot of evidence was already in the public domain. One former senior Metropolitan Police officer with extensive experience of sensitive investigations said the force had unnecessarily got itself into trouble and was concerned by its missteps so far, some of which were branded brain dead. The source said they're making it up as they go along. The former Chief Whip, Mark Harper, had pushed for Sue Gray's report to be published in full. He told The Guardian, "A partial publication with crucial details missing would be an insult to the British public." Roger Gale, a backbencher who has already submitted a letter of no confidence in Boris Johnson, said the soaring cost of living and recent tensions between Russia and Ukraine required Boris Johnson's full and undivided attention, but instead, he was a lame duck prime minister that is soldiering on. The British government was also accused of being in paralysis by the Labour leader, Keir Starmer. He criticised ministers for being focused on protecting Boris Johnson's position, while people concerned about the tax rise coming into effect in April and rising bills were getting no answers from a government mired in sleaze and scandal. Following news that only a redacted version of Sue Gray's report was expected, Ian Blackford, the Scottish National Party's leader in Westminster, said, "No one will accept a Westminster cover-up. If the British government refuses to publish the full, unredacted report, it will prove yet again that Westminster is utterly corrupt and broken beyond repair. It won't save Boris Johnson's skin. It will only add to the cause for him to go." Public health experts on Friday, 28th of January, noted the lack of briefings or communication from the government at a time when coronavirus rules had changed. Case rates remained very high, and COVID was continuing to cause significant disruption in schools. Professor Gabriel Scally, a visiting professor of public health at the University of Bristol, said, "We're in a really difficult position, particularly for children and young people, and the government continues to dither and delay." He added, "The government is putting down the blind on things in the hope that we will move on." Professor Linda Bold, a public health expert at the University of Edinburgh, said the lack of communication was problematic. She said, "There are continued scientific developments, such as the inclusion of reinfection figures in daily case numbers, which people probably need explained." James Johnson, a pollster with JL Partners who worked in Downing Street under Theresa May, said, "I don't think the brand damage from the parties fades. Voter perceptions of Boris Johnson have changed for good, barring some major event." James Johnson claimed, "This is very much a Johnson issue, not a wider Conservative Party issue. If, sooner rather than later, MPs look to a new leader, then I think you get an almost entire restart moment. And actually, I think that You could even see the Conservative government as much as 10 points ahead almost overnight.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
Old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle, and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It's like answers, really, just so my nana can rest and I can rest and my family can rest and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just say, feed your medication, kill the pain, you're right, you'll be right. And next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look epidemiologically and clinically at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
That's work from sunup to sundown, for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War. 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums and their swags and everything. They used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any work day. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head sharanks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes, everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, if they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white, or bleached white, where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many, and if any, they're sick today.
Mainly headaches at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When you're going to see the doctor.
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife Marion has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had like constant heart attacks, unconscious. Oh, they told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to their normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Ollie interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44 gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20 litre drums. The stuff in the 20 litre drums was like engine oil and or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me? You know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to all these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protected clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic, and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles, or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, not the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yeah.
If you could...
And indeed, I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
Getting a rash on there too. There's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just funny, hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so yeah, and I'm more confined to a wheelchair. Put my shirt down now.
No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this, and it's something that you can't fix, you know. Can't kiss it better, can't put a band-aid on it, and I've just got to watch him, and I don't like to. I've got to try and keep strong.
More than 3 decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
It's horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. Now, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What?
They look like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial and I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities.
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The increasing popularity of cryptocurrency has environmentalists on edge, as the digital mining of it creates a massive carbon footprint due to the staggering amount of energy it requires. We now present you an article written by Robin Scher, a writer based in South Africa and a graduate of the Cultural Reporting and Criticism Program at New York University. The piece is titled, As Crypto Goes Mainstream, Its Carbon Footprint Can't Be Ignored. Advocates of cryptocurrency, the promise of an economic future that is managed by a blockchain, a decentralized database that is shared among the nodes of a computer network as opposed to being held in a single location such as a central bank, is compelling. For anyone paying attention, the rapid expansion of cryptocurrency has been stunning. In 2019, the global cryptocurrency market was approximately $793 million. According to a report by the market research organization Facts and Factors, it's now expected to reach nearly $5.2 billion by 2026. In just 1 year, between July of 2020 and June of 2021, the global adoption of cryptocurrencies surged by more than